Welcome to Denko Way session. An ancient Buddha said, all Buddhas and all sentient beings are just one mind, outside of which nothing exists. It often feels as if we're separate people in a world of separate things. But as we settle more and more into the spaciousness of open awareness, it becomes harder to find the boundaries between self and other. It's as if there's one big spacious mind that, for reasons unknown to us, manifested as you and me and all sentient beings. As we speak and listen to each other, where is that distinct boundary between my awareness and your awareness? If we look carefully, it's hard to find. And yet, this manifestation of all these sentient beings appears, and we come along with a bunch of karmic tendencies. But could it be that our job in this life is to accord with this one mind and when one of us is in accord with this one mind and another is in accord with this one mind, then these two of us can meet in accord also. Could this be the purpose, the very purpose of our lives as sentient beings, to accord with the way, the boundless awareness, and then to meet a so-called other in this open space and see how these two manifestations of the one mind are also in accord, and that the Zen tradition seems to emphasize this meeting of two beings, apparently two beings, in the space of one mind, and it's sometimes called transmission. So this is the transmission of light assembly we're having this week. Now, one of the ancients said, actually, transmission, this word transmission, is a misnomer. And it's confusing because it sounds like then something would be transmitted from one person to another. So it's sometimes been said in Zen, this word transmission actually means to be in accord. For a person to be in accord with this one mind, and then to meet another person in accord with this one mind, and the two people meet in accord. I think when usually, most of the time, we're not in touch with this one mind. We're more in touch with how we're separate beings. And we can still meet like that, but the meetings of these ancestors, the transmission of light, seems to be when two people are in accord with this light, and then they try to meet and be in accord with each other. So all these stories of the ancestors are like this. And often the way to accord, and almost like to check, for the two beings to check if they're in accord, most of these stories involve using words and language to do that, because that's like one of our main forms of communication, is it not? It's so subtle, this light, that if we just say, yeah, I'm in the light, you're in the light, we're in the light together, we may be fooling ourselves. Therefore, words are very helpful, and also words are problematic, because words are what divide the one space into discrete entities. So there's a special kind of Zen language, it's very strange, that appears in these stories. But this very first story of transmission, or really the second story, some of us the past couple of days heard about the first transmission of light, which was a meeting of Shakyamuni Buddha and the morning star. And the morning star transmitted the light to Shakyamuni Buddha, or if we don't want to use that misnomer, we could say the morning star was in accord with the light already, and when Shakyamuni Buddha came into accord with the light and met the morning star, then they were in accord. Now, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, meets a person, the first ancestor of the Zen lineage. And this meeting is also important because one person can accord with the way, and we talked about yesterday, how do you know if you're in accord or not? And I, little me, can't really assess that. But our true being can confirm. Little me, little mind can't confirm being in accord, but big mind is the only thing they can confirm. So the way, the light, can confirm an individual's accord with the way, and that's essential to this Zen project. But that's not all. Part of the uniqueness of the Zen project is there's a confirmation of this one mind by this one mind, but then there's also a confirmation from another who is confirmed by the one mind. So it's never it's never just a matter of self-confirmation in Zen. And that's what this whole book is about. The first ancestor was Maha Kashyapa. Once the world-honored one, the Buddha held up a flower and blinked. Kashyapa smiled. The world-honored one said, I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye the wondrous mind of Nirvana, and I entrust it to Mahakashyapa. Mahakashyapa, Buddha's disciple, before he left home, was married to Bada Kapilani. Y'all know that?
Yeah.
One of our woman ancestors, Bada Kapilani, and Mahakashyapa were a couple for many, many lifetimes, they said, over and over again. And in this lifetime of the Buddha, neither one of them wanted to get married. They wanted to just leave home and practice as the renunciate, forest-dwelling life. And but their parents really wanted them to. It's part of Indian culture. And to inherit the large estate of Mahakashyapa's parents and to accord with social norms. So finally, there's many stories about this. This is in the great disciples of the Buddha, many stories about Mahakashyapa and Vada Kapilani. But finally, somehow, the parents convinced them, and the way they did it was the parents were trying to arrange this marriage, and maybe they hadn't even met each other, but they wrote these notes to each other that said, actually, you know, this is very nice that our parents are doing this, but and I have nothing against you personally, but actually, I just want to, like, leave home and practice this renunciate way. And they both wrote these notes to each other, but their parents intercepted the notes and wrote forged notes that said, I'd love to meet you. Let's get together downtown for dinner. So that's what happened. They got together and they lived happily, still and practicing all the time in their complex life, because Mahakashyapa inherited this big farm and property, and they still had this intention that, well, maybe like later in our old age we'll be able to leave home like our original intention. But then one day Mahakashyapa was watching his farm hands plow the large fields, and he saw how the furrows got turned up and the worms all came to the surface, and then these birds came down and ate the worms. And in his great compassionate heart, he felt like, oh, this is so painful to watch. This death of precious sentient beings. And he knew about the teachings of karma and asked the farmhands, well, this is so sad. What about the karmic effects of this, all this death happening here? And the farmhand said, well, actually, this karma was coming to you, Mahakashyapa, because it's your farm. And meanwhile, Bada Kapilani was drying the sesame seeds out in the sun, and the insects came to feed on the sesame seeds, and the birds came and ate them too. And she had the same experience of like, this is so painful. And her kitchen assistant said, well, it's sort of your karma, Bada Kapilani, because you set this up. the footnote to this story is kind of interesting because it says, actually, this is not exactly in accord with Buddha's teaching, because Buddha's teaching says that karma is intention to kill, and they didn't have the intention to kill, actually. So it's not exactly that the karmic effects are necessarily ripen on them in exactly this way. But they're involved, right? And they felt painful about being involved. And that was the thing that turned them over the edge. And they said, we don't need to keep doing this. Let's go. Let's go. And they shaved each other's heads and put on robes, rag robes, and walked off. And eventually met the Buddha, joined the Buddha Sangha, and both of them realized enlightenment. They all lived happily ever after. So, today happens to be Rob and Rain's wedding anniversary. And they're celebrating their marriage by leaving their home and coming to sit all day with the Sangha, just like Mahakashyapa and Bada Kapilani. Now Keizan Zenji, our Soto ancestor, talks a little bit about Mahakashyapa's life. The Venerable Mahakashyapa's family was Brahmin. In India, he was called Kashyapa, which in our country means light drinker. Not that he was like a light drinker. Or he only drank light. But he was a drinker of light. This is the transmission of light record. So Kashyapa's name apparently means light drinker, drinker of light. When he was born, a golden light filled the room, and all of it entered his mouth. Maybe that's why he was called light drinker. Therefore, he was called light drinker. His body had a golden color as well as 30 marks, lacking only 2 of the Buddha's marks. We talked about the other day, the Buddha has these 32 physical marks. And Mahakashyapa had 30. He only lacked the protuberance on top of his head and the tuft of white hairs between his eyebrows. Otherwise, he was just like the Buddha. He met the world-honored one, the Buddha, in front of the stupa of many children. That's the name of a stupa. When the world-honored one said, "Welcome, monk," his hair fell off. And he shed his earthly body and was miraculously clothed in a kesa, or a monk's robe. So it's like, when he met the Buddha, in this story, he didn't even have to bother having his head shaved and sewing a robe. His hair just popped out and a robe sprouted on his body. The world-honored one said, "Welcome, monk, ehi bhikkhu." And the old sutras say that actually this was in the old days of the Buddha, this is how ordinations happened, in the very earliest days. There weren't any precepts yet, and there weren't any ceremonies. The Sangha started very informally. So if you wanted to join the Buddha's Sangha as a monk, you just come up to the Buddha, and he says, "Welcome, monk," and that's the ordination. And the old texts describe how as the Sangha grew, they needed more forms and ceremonies. So then the ordination became taking refuge in the three treasures three times and receiving the precepts, which we do today. But when Mahakashyapa met the Buddha, they didn't yet have that ceremony. Just, welcome, monk. Ehi bhikkhu. Also, Mahakashyapa was entrusted with the treasury of the true Dharma eye by the Buddha. That's the Shobo Genzo, the true Dharma eye treasury. He practiced the 12 austerities and never vainly wasted his time during the night or day. And I'll spare you listing the 12 austerities unless you force me to, because it might scare you. But basically, so practices that the Buddha didn't require, but that he permitted. People were doing all kinds of austere practices in India, and the Buddha already had hundreds of precepts for the monks, but some of the monks were like, 250 precepts aren't enough, I want more practice opportunities. So he said, well, we have these 12 austerities that are not harmful to your body and mind. Because other yogis were doing things like looking at the sun until their eyes burned out, and like, you know, holding one arm in the air until it rotted away, and some crazy stuff. The Buddha was into the middle way, which didn't exclude austerity, but it should be not harmful to body and mind. So they're basically just like limiting food, clothing, and lodging. They're all about that. Simplifying for the sake of simplicity, simplifying how we get food and what we eat, how we get clothes and what we wear, and how we get a dwelling and take care of it. So, Mahakashyapa was practiced these 12 austerities. Seeing his emaciated body and uncouth clothing, the whole community of monks was struck with wonder. Another translation says, the whole community of monks doubted him. We could say, wow, that's amazing, he's so austere. But another way to translate it is like, I don't know about this guy, grubby old guy, like, he's not practicing properly. They doubted him. When the Buddha taught the Dharma, as a result of this, maybe as a result of either of them being in wonder or doubting him, as a result, when the Buddha taught the Dharma, he shared his seat at each assembly with Kashyapa, saying, I like this guy, I like his style. From then on, Kashyapa was the senior among the monks. Not only was he the senior monk at the assemblies of Shakyamuni, but also the non-regressing senior monk among the assemblies of all past Buddhas. You should know that he was an old Buddha and not think that he was simply one of Buddha's ordinary disciples, Keizan says. Also, before an assembly of 80,000 monks on Vulture Peak, Mount Gurudakuta, the world-honored one held up a flower and blinked. None of the assembly understood his mind and remained silent. Mahakashyapa alone smiled. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye treasury, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, the complete and perfect, bright, pure, signless Dharma gate. And I entrust it completely to Mahakashyapa, the true Dharma eye, wisdom eye, treasury, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, peace and freedom, is nirvana, and the complete, bright, signless Dharma gate. It's bright and clear, and at the same time, it has no signs by which to get a hold of it. Signs are how we know things. And all of this I entrust to Mahakashyapa. So, this meeting of the Buddha and Mahakashyapa in Dogen's essay on face-to-face transmission, he says, Mahakashyapa's face was no longer his own. Thus he received the Buddha's face by means of this face-to-face transmission. His face, Mahakashyapa's face, was no longer his own. It was like a light, a face of light. Like his face, they're like, I'm Mahakashyapa, and I used to live on that farm with Bhadakapilani and so on. That face was no longer his face. Not that that face didn't exist, but now his face was just an openness in the present moment. His face was no longer his own. And at the time his face was no longer his own, he received the Buddha's face in face-to-face transmission. So it's always a meeting of faces. But not like karmic faces of like, I'm the guy who was farming with Bhadakapilani. Those faces can meet too, but in this is like not his own face, meeting the Buddha's not his own face. Dogen goes on saying, you receive face-to-face transmission by exchanging your face. This face skin, this face skin is the great perfect mirror of all Buddhas. A great perfect mirror transmits to a great perfect mirror. I've heard in the old days, we don't do this anymore, but I've read texts where part of the Dharma transmission ceremony is you hold like a mirror behind your head, and the teacher does too. You actually take out like an actual round mirror and reflect each other to symbolize a mirror meeting another mirror. The face skin is a great round perfect mirror meeting the face skin of another so-called other, mirror to mirror, big mind to big mind. And I don't think that this excludes appearances on the face of the mirror, like eyes, nose, ears, and mouth. I mean, the mirror doesn't exclude any appearances, right? So we could look at a face with eyes, nose, ears, and mouth, and kind of see the mirror that's like holding those images. Maybe possible. The thing is, I say see the mirror, but a mirror, when you look in a bathroom mirror, it's very hard to see the mirror, right? Because we basically just see the reflection on it. But we can know that that's actually a mirror. Even when we see eye to eye, there's a mirror behind the eye. And can we be in accord with our mirror and the other's mirrors when the eyes and noses meet? Also, in Dogen's essay called Udambara Flower, where Udambara Flower is this legendary flower that only appears once in every like 10,000 years. And in that story, the Buddha says, on Vulture Peak, the Buddha held up an Udambara Flower, and that's what Mahakashyapa saw it wasn't just any old flower. So in this Uttambara essay, Dogen says, "Now holding up a flower existed before the world-honored one attained enlightenment." In other words, it seemed like at a certain moment Walter Peake held up this flower, but Dogen says the holding up the flower already was happening before the Buddha's awakening. It took place at the same time that the Buddha realized awakening. It has taken place after he attained awakening. In this way, the flower attains awakening. Holding up the flower goes beyond these three times of past, present, and future. Thus Gotama, the world-honored one, entered the flower and hid in emptiness. Can we enter this stick and hide in emptiness? Holding up a flower, Dogen says, is just sitting, dropping off body and mind. When the Buddha held up the flower on Vulture Peak. Actually, that was just wholeheartedly sitting, dropping off body and mind. Keizan says, the so-called holding up a flower of that time has been intimately transmitted from ancestor to ancestor. It's been indiscriminately, it's not been indiscriminately transmitted to outsiders. Therefore, it's not been understood by teachers of sutras and shastras, of scriptures and treatises, and it not even understood by many Zen teachers. In truth, they did not understand its true meaning. So Zen is often called the separate transmission outside the scriptures, and sometimes says the teachers of scriptures have a hard time getting this, because it doesn't come in that package. Be that as it may, imo, such as it is, this koan is not the koan of the assembly on Vulture Peak, but rather the words entrusted at the stupa of many children. Do you remember the words at the stupa of many children earlier in the story? When the Buddha first met Mahakashyapa at the stupa of many children. Exactly. Welcome, monk. So Keizan's saying, in truth, this koan of the entrustment of the Buddha to Mahakashyapa did not happen holding up the flower on Vulture Peak. It happened when they first met, the first meeting, and the Buddha just said, welcome, monk. It's not a matter of what was said on Vulture Peak as claimed by the transmission of flame records and the universal flame records and others. When the Buddha Dharma was entrusted the very first time to Mahakashyapa, there was this kind of ceremony. The ceremony of welcome, monk. And Dogen Zenji also, as the story goes, he said, he was traveling all around China, looking to meet mirrors, and wasn't satisfied. And at some point he came to the mountain of Tendo Nyojo, and he said, on our first meeting, we met face to face, and Tendo Nyojo Daiyosho said, the Dharma of face-to-face transmission is now complete. Something like that. And then they started practicing together. And then at the end of their time together, they did other ceremonies of copying documents and things like that. And though this is, you know, borderline secret to talk about these transmission ceremonies, it's nice to let you know, I think, that even in our modern ceremonies where we spend a week doing lots and lots of complex ceremonies, the beginning of the week starts with this very simple face-to-face meeting. And it's said in our tradition, in current times, that's the complete Dharma transmission before the week starts. And then it gets really complicated after that. And it's even possible in the Sotoshu bylaws in Japan, there's all kinds of bylaws, you know, of this sect. One of them is that it's permitted in the tradition to do like a kind of deathbed entrustment. When a teacher and a student have a long connection, and teacher is suddenly about to die and hasn't finished all these complex ceremonies, they can just do that. It's called like the you know, deathbed face-to-face transmission. And my own teacher, I've heard, you know, he had a heart attack one time, and it seemed he really thought that it was a likely chance he might die. And I heard he did this with one of his senior disciples on the hospital bed, and he didn't die. Was able to do lots of complicated stuff after that. So, is that what Keizan's referring to here when he says, in truth, it was not this meeting on Vulture Peak after they'd been practicing a long time that this koan is about. This koan is about their very first meeting. Keizan says, if you are not an ancestral teacher who transmits the Buddha mind seal, you don't understand the occasion of this holding up the flower. Or the other translation says, if he, Mahakashyapa, was not an ancestral teacher who transmits the Buddha mind seal, he would not understand the occasion of holding up the flower, nor would he understand the Zen virtue of holding up the flower. You must meticulously study and carefully experience it. Understand that Kashyapa is Kashyapa, and clarify that Shakyamuni is Shakyamuni, and singularly transmit the perfectly pure, awakened, bright way. Put aside for a while the holding up of the flower and clarify the blinking. So, this is Dogen's Udambara flower essay talking about this story. Dogen says, blinking. This is a commentary on blinking. In our lineage, we have to study things like blinking. Exhaustively penetrate blinking. Dogen says, Blinking takes place when the Tathagata sits pervasively under the tree and replaces his eyeball with the morning star. Only Dogen can say things like this. Again, blinking takes place when the Tathagata sits all pervasively under the tree and replaces his eyeball with the morning star. At that moment, Mahakashyapa smiles. We might even say, the whole universe smiles. Andrew offers smiling heart qigong. So, the heart smiles, the morning star smiles, the moon smiles, the Bodhi tree smiles, the Mahakashyapa smiles, Ananda smiles, Shonawashu smiles, Dogen smiles. We smile! I think I read somewhere that the sometimes when the Chinese way of saying smile is cracking a face. It's like when one's face cracks, that's what a smile is. Like there's a kind of solid face. Cracks.
Cracking a smile.
Cracking a smile, yeah, we say, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cracking a smile. Sometimes, maybe like the sutra and treatise teachers use a chisel on the stone face for a long time. And eventually there's this slight smile appearance. It takes a long time to crack that smile, but the Zen ancestors can just hold up a smile. Yeah, they can hold up a smile. Or a flower. At the very moment, Dogen says, of taking up the flower, all Gotamas, all Siddhartha Gotamas, all Mahakashyapas, all sentient beings, all of us, hold up a single hand together, taking up the flower. This has never ceased until now. Up to now. So when the Buddha holds up a flower, all Buddhas and all sentient beings and all of us hold out a single hand, holding the flower continuously up to now. This is the kind of flower holding the Buddha does. Within this hand, this one hand that we all hold up with the flower, is the samadhi of hiding the body. In our Dokusan room here, we have many treasures of Zen ancestors, and one of them is a calligraphy by Dainin Katagiri Roshi. Rare treasure in this world. It's the calligraphy to the right of the altar in there, and it says, hiding the body, which Dogen uses here and several other places. Zoshin, hiding the body. Within this one hand we all hold out with the flower is the samadhi, the absorption of hiding the body. Hiding the body, one of these Zen phrases that refers to dropping off the body, and also refers to, this is in Kaz Tanahashi's extensive bibliography to the Shobogenzo, hiding the body, is dropping off the body, and it's also the intimate meeting of face to face, teacher and disciple.
To be in accord.
To be in accord, yeah, to be in accord. And isn't that wonderful that it has this double meaning? To drop off our idea of me is actually also means to be in accord. It means like hiding my limited body in your body. You hiding your body in my body. Both of us hiding our flesh bodies in the Dharma body. Hiding the body. Provocative phrase. But when we all hold up the flower together, which has been happening since beginning this time, there is this absorption, samadhi, one-pointed subtleness in hiding the body.
Didn't you say something earlier about entering the emptiness in the...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, very similar. Very similar. Dogen says... the world honored one entered the flower and hid in emptiness. He entered the flower and hid in emptiness.
Is that sort of representative of the flower? Traditionally?
No. It doesn't represent anything. This is the flower. This is the flower. This is the flower. That's the flower. Those stinking lilies on the altar are the flower.
Yeah, I'm surprised those are in here.
Somehow they found their way in, and we try not to exclude anyone. So. Oh boy. So, put aside for a while, Kazan says now, in the transmission of light, Kazan says, put aside for a while this holding up the flower and clarify the blinking. There's not a hair's breadth of difference between your ordinary lifting your eyebrows and blinking and Gotama's blinking and holding up the flower. How could there be a hair's breadth of difference? Do we think that the Buddha's blink was like a really special blink? I mean, he was the Buddha after all, so it was a Buddha blink. But the way the Buddha blinks, how could it be different from the way we blink? And how does actually a blink happen anyway? It's not really in our control. I mean, we can decide once in a while to, on the count of three, blink. One, two, three. But usually it doesn't work that way, right? That's why a whole lot of the Zen ancestors celebrate raising eyebrows and blinking, because it's just so to kind of a, like a natural, spontaneous activity. And so ordinary. There's not a hair's breadth of difference between your ordinary lifting of the eyebrows and blinking and Gotama's holding up the flower and blinking. There's not a hair's breadth of difference between your speaking and smiling and Mahakashapa's breaking into a smile. However, if you don't know who it was who raised his eyebrows and blinked, then Shakyamuni and Mahakashapa are in some ancient time in India, and skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are within you. In other words, we're just this body of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, and Shakyamuni and Mahakashyapa are some distant characters in India. As long as we don't know who it is who raises the eyebrows and blinks. Who is it, actually, who raises the eyebrows and blinks?
Gotcha.
Gotcha.
Gotcha Marx.
Gaucho. 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 But who is Gaucho, actually? Who is Gaucho, actually? I remember that our later ancestor, Yao Shan, there's a whole long involved stories about sometimes making his raise his eyebrows and blink, and sometimes not making him raise his eyebrows and blink, and sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is just right, and sometimes it's not right. How about you? But the verse, I remembered Kazan's verse to this story. So it's a little hint. We're kind of reading ahead in the book here. Kazan says, we have to know who it is who raises his eyebrows and blinks. Later he says, Kazan says, that one, capital T, capital O, the host, that one whose whole life is extremely active and lively, we call the one who raises the eyebrows and blinks. The lord of the house, the host of the shop, the moon that follows each boat on its moonlit journey home. That one makes us raise our eyebrows and blink. Who is that one? Well, he has no name. But he's always with us. She doesn't really care if we have a totally deluded thought. She doesn't care if we think incessantly through an entire 5-day session. She doesn't care if me and you ever realize the way. She doesn't care what's for lunch. But she loves us unconditionally. She's holding us. She will never, ever abandon us.
She cares.
She cares enough to give the very best. So, she cares and she doesn't care. Because it's just unconditional compassion, but she doesn't care how that manifests. She cares how it manifests. How so? She She wants us to be totally happy like that. But if we, if it looks this way or that way, maybe we could say that's the part that she doesn't have a preference of how our life manifests as long as we're free and at ease. Therefore, we could manifest in any moment as Groucho. So, but if we don't know her, who makes our eyebrows raise and our eyes blink, then these stories are just some, like, quaint old folk tales from long ago. So many flowers in your eyes, Kazan says. So much floating dust. We've not been liberated for countless eons, and for eons to come will be sunk if we don't get to know her. If only once you thoroughly know the host, Kazan says, then Mahakashapa will be able to move his toes in your sandals. Don't you know that Gotama completely vanished when he raised his eyebrows and blinked, and that Kashapa was awakened when he smiled? Isn't it our own then? The true Dharma eye treasury has been completely transmitted to you yourselves, to oneself. Therefore, it cannot be called Kashyapa or Shakyamuni. Never presenting anything to others, never receiving the Dharma from another, this is called the true Dharma. In order to indicate that, the Buddha held up a flower and showed that it was unchanging. Kashyapa smiled to show that it was eternal. In this way, Shakyamuni and Mahakashyapa mutually saw each other and their life vein intermingled, flowed through. Perfectly pure, complete understanding is not involved with the ordinary discriminating mind, so Mahakashyapa sat in meditation and cut the root of conceptual thought. Could it be that the root of conceptual thought can be cut and then still a flow of so-called thoughts can come forth with the root cut? Otherwise, Mahakashyapa would have just been like a drooling zombie forever, right? We have to think, but we have to cut the root of thought. Then Mahakashyapa entered Mount Kukutapada, Roosterfoot Mountain, where he awaits the future appearance of Maitreya. Even now, Mahakashyapa has not entered Nirvana. So that's the legend, is after this transmission, one old story even says that the Buddha passed his robe to Mahakashyapa and said, would you mind giving this to Maitreya, the next Buddha, when you see him next? And Mahakashyapa said, sure, but it's going to be several eons, so I'm gonna hide inside this mountain until Maitreya comes and then pass him Shakyamuni Buddha's robe. That's one story we have. There's more, of course. But you must wait for another time. May any positive energy arisen here, may any faces that have cracked into smiles be dedicated and offered throughout the universe to all beings. May they all realize this one single hand holding up the flower from beginningless time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.